Blog Talk Radio.
And I am outside at Poolside with some friends of mine that I've known since they were just little friends. And we're at the Musa residence with the brothers Musa. And we're going to be, I'm going to introduce you to them in just a few minutes. But before we get there, I want to know, what the heck is the mister talking about? You know, I'm going to have a commentary at the end of the show. But all you knuckleheads out there that didn't get off your butt and voted at the last, during the last primary, there's plenty of you out there, because even though Amendment 1, people rushed out to vote for it, they say 61%. Did not happen. So we're going to be discussing that. We're going to have a call from a few people, Marsha Harvey, Soil and Water Commissioner in Wake County, Grace Leem. Oh, Gracelyn Galloway now. She had a runaway marriage last weekend. And she went and got married in Vegas. So if she gets a chance to break away, we might be able to get her on the show. And we also are going to have the brothers Musa. Can you guys say hello to the listening audience?
Hey, I'm Matt Musa.
Hey, I'm John.
And
having us on, Mike.
And that's all they're going to say, because I won't have to say anything else. They'll just keep them in the background here for the rest of the time. But we're going to be discussing a lot of the things that you heard about the Democratic Party during the last 6 weeks, particularly the Democratic chair, and how he, well, in my alternative world, rigged the election for him to get reelected again. But, you know, when you don't go and vote, when you don't put up a fight, you get what you deserve. Now, while we're waiting for Marshall to call in, Matt, I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
I had a discussion with a friend of mine, Thomas Fortenberry, and you don't remember Thomas because you were just a little tight then, and you were into your own little, I don't know, it was a He-Man world, it was figurines you used to play with.
I'm sensing an age differential.
Oh, that age is, okay.
Dolls?
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, there was this guy, Thomas Fortenberry. He is a, and so you missed that show, we talked about DC and Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we had a talk about language and how language is taking up a major portion of people's, the ordinary person's day. But the ordinary person doesn't know what language actually means when it's said. Especially when we're talking about the political aspects of what a communist is, and a Marxist is,
mm-hmm.
and a Leninist is, and a theocrat is. And you know, at one time, according to the Pillsbury Doughboy Newt Gingrich, Barack Obama was all of them. A communist, a socialist, a theocrat, a Marxist, and a Leninist.
Well, at least we know he's not lazy, huh?
Hey, give me a break. So, now we were talking about that before we came on the show. What is a communist?
Well, a communist is any person who believes in the organization of a state that has the collective wealth of its people that it basically presides over. So, in order for communism to, in order to be, have a communist state, you need to have a group of people who decide collectively, and it's typically referred to as the proletariat because they're the working class. You must have a proletariat. You can't just have a bourgeois society or a very high elite information society. You need to have a proletariat that has certain things like resources that have a cash value or a societal value, a worth that can be collected through a central organization, aka the government, and then redistributed over the entire populace at an equal interval. So in a way, it is sort of a utopian society, because regardless of your place in society, you all have an equal share as a collective whole in the society.
Well, how can that be? How can North Korea be a communist society?
Well, it's quite simple, actually. They're not. That's the problem. This is where a lot of people lose concentration and accuracy when they start calling everybody communists and socialists and Leninists, Marxists. Those are all very.
How about if Saul Alinsky was? Saul Alinsky. You heard about him, right?
Oh,
we'll get to that. Good.
But countries like North Korea, the former Soviet Union, China, these are countries that espouse the fundamentals of communism, and to a greater point, their originator, Marxism and Engels. However, they at the end of the day, they always make it to the collectivization. They always get all the resources together under one government that has all the power. But for some reason, they never seem to get to that point where they distribute it equally amongst the people. It just gets to the collectivization, and then it stalls, and then you have what is hypothetically an oligarchy with all the resources under control of any single of an entire people. And that's what countries that's what a lot of these countries are, like North Korea. I believe in 2008 they spent $6 million to get 3G access across their country, and there were 8 people who could access it on their cell phones.
Well, you know, we had a speaking about 3 people getting access. There is a major problem with people who who don't have access. Now, what do you call them who don't have access?
Access to what?
To anything.
To what we enjoy here in
No, we didn't get to us yet. In North Korea.
You call those North Koreans. fundamentally, though, those people, what you call them is you call them underprivileged. You call them, they're essentially enslaved by a government. But the worst part about North Korea is not that they starve their people of food, but they starve their people of water. They starve their people of hope, but really what they starve their people of is information. And a society with no information of the outside world, without the ability to learn diverse readings and follow and learn new practices from other people, they cannot represent themselves and they can never organize themselves because they are starved of what you need, information.
Now, this information you're giving us is because you're a communist, is this correct?
Because
giving information isn't that a communist tendency?
Yes, the communist people, as they're supposed to be, they're collectively equal, they all have the same knowledge of their society.
Right.
There's complete transparency because they all take part in it.
Okay, so therefore, if the Pillsbury Doughboy calls Barack Obama a communist, that means he's giving information to his people.
No. Well, although Barack Obama's, he espouses, one of his tenets is transparency of government, I think Newt Gingrich's point is that because Barack Obama believes in social programs, as much of traditionally the Democratic Party has upheld, that he is in some way a communist because he takes money from people to fund his own programs. But it's just political. It's just nonsense.
What do you think about that, John?
As far as what he said to...
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think when you only have so much to complain about somebody, you have to reach. And like anybody, you can make up fairy tales. And
so like Grimm's fairy tales.
Yeah, and you can make them fit to, you know, whatever, you know, villain you want, whether it be true or not. And like anything, you tell enough people, it's sort of like, you know, when you're in elementary school, in kindergarten, and you play the game where, you know, you tell the person next to you, you know, the cat is blue. And by the time you get around the whole room, you know, they just said, you know, your last name is Smith. And it's like, you know, that's not what the first person said, you know. But you go around and it gets lost in translation.
The telephone game aside, words like communist, socialist, neocon, conservative, these words get thrown around so often in our society these days, they've actually lost the meaning they have. And I can tell you with some certainty, if you go out and find a real communist, regardless of which sect they follow,
they don't have to wear one of them suits that are tied up with the buttons on the front.
I think that's a Chinese.
Oh, that's
something. I think it's a Chinese red star uniform.
Because I think Dr. No wore that in
Evil communist inside. Any real communist who believes in the tenets of communism would be furious that you call Obama a communist. That's an insult to communism. Not to be rude, but it's an insult to communism, if that's what you believe.
Well, I mean, Donald said that he was a communist.
Donald Trump's good for a lot of things, but outside of a laugh, not much.
Well, now, wait a minute. See, now you mentioned the word neocon. And not mentioning Dick Cheney when we were talking about neocon, but neocon is what got us into the war in Iraq.
Is neocon like Latin for oil?
Yeah, you know, we need to look that up.
It's actually Latin for new conservatism.
Oh, new conservatism.
That's what neo is.
Oh, neo. That like Neo from the blue pill and the red pill? No?
I think the Matrix movies were much more successful than most neoconservatives.
Well, Jonathan, now listen. Both of you are, let's see. You're not communist. Well, you see, but are you the Willy Brandt communist, or is he a capitalist? What is Willy Brandt?
Willy Brandt.
He's the Prime Minister of Germany at one time. Remember, way back when?
During the DDR?
Yeah.
Well, I can't tell you what I was in the 70s, probably because I wasn't conceptualized yet by my parents. I mean, I'm 23, but the former DDR mirrored almost completely its Western origins.
Right.
It's American capitalism, pretty much. But mm-hmm. Willy Brandt was not communist. I mean, well, we're not. Me and my brother don't think we're communists or anything. I am not socially conservative by any means. I believe, and I'm very socially liberal. However, I'm very fiscally conservative, and I believe that while I don't think things like Amendment 1 in North Carolina should even come to the table. I don't even believe that should be voted on. If anything, I believe there should be an amendment that says it bans the definition of marriage by the state. I don't think my state should have any part in defining what marriage is. I believe that's separation of church and state. I think the only thing a state should have, the state should have an ability to decide is what the definition of a civil union is and what the law decides a civil union is. However, at the same time, I believe in those things, I believe fiscal conservatism is also the balance to that. I think that spending in our government today has become rampant, and it's become bloated, and I don't blame either party. I blame a collective whole and a collective failure to correct for that.
The collective. Now we're talking communists. Okay, well, before, I want to hold it up because I got a caller in here. Let's see who this is on the line. Hello there. Who's this?
Mike Marshall.
Oh, Mr. Marshall, we have to turn you up for your volume just a little.
I got tired of traffic and couldn't get to a stable place.
You couldn't get to a stable place. Well, how can you get to a stable place? You're in the Democratic Party.
yeah, you got a point there. You got a real good point there.
Awesome. I was just talking to the brothers Musa here about some words that are used quite often with the regressive party. Communist, socialist, theocrat, you know, those neocon, which it seems that the president has been all of them all at one time. Now, but what I want you to tell me is, what the heck is going on with the Democratic Party in the state of North Carolina?
What's going on with them?
Yeah.
Michael, we're in flux right now.
Flux.
I think
flapping wings.
No, I think we're undecided on most issues and can't make a decision on any of them. I just left a conversation with Brad Thompson, and we were talking about how do you think what happened last week will affect the president in the state of North Carolina. Well, I think we drew the conclusion that it possibly would hurt him on the party level.
Mm-hmm.
David Parker tried to resign and couldn't. Found out at that point that there were no clause plan of operation that was speaking to the a person, an officer resigning. There we need to go back and look at a lot of things that we're doing, but this year is such a critical year for us because if we don't take back, number one, the state house in North Carolina and the keep the presidency and take over some seats in the house, the U.S. house, we're going to be in trouble for the next 2 years. Maybe 10 years from now, the effects of it. Because if we keep continually cutting our school funding on the state level, North Carolina would have the worst public school system in the the least funded one in the United States.
Well, public school and college level.
Say that again, Michael.
The public school and on the college level. We went from, six down to 47, I think, or is it 48 now? Mississippi is creeping right up our back. I mean, and they don't even speak English down there.
Well, you know, the governor got in a little tit-for-tat with the governor of Mississippi about something that she said. But it's critical that we keep a good school system in order. If you don't, people are not going to stop. People are going to stop coming to North Carolina. And I think that the pledge that Republicans took on the night that the president was inaugurated, that they were going to do everything to make sure that he had a terrible experience as president of the United States, and that whatever he had, they would not cooperate with him. Said by any means necessary, and we've all heard that term before because Malcolm X used it quite a bit.
But right.
They're using it now. They're using it now. Any means necessary, and they have captured so many state houses, legislatures in the United States that it's almost possible for them to do that. And it's really crazy because if the Democrats lose, they also lose, and if we lose. Country, we're really going to be in trouble, and we're at the point now where we're almost losing it.
The problem is, because they want to change everything, and they'd rather have the ship go down in flames and then build a new ship in their own eyes sometime down the road.
That's very true, Michael. That is very true. And as I said earlier, by any means necessary, they are willing to destroy the nation, period. President Obama seems like a non-credible president. I think he's done great things for the country. He's saved the auto industry, in which we don't realize the fact that the auto industry plays an important role in all of our lives. Auto industry had failed, we don't know what we would be doing right now.
What I wanted to say before, if the ship goes down in the ocean, you may not be able to get to shore if the sharks eat you first.
That's true. Well, they're willing to take that risk.
Yeah, they're willing to take that risk I can't swim. And there's no more Middle West or lifeboats. So, but the thing is that the auto industry, see, a lot of dumb people who are low information voters from Fox News, not speaking about information voters, but speaking about low information voters from Fox News, they don't understand that the auto industry just isn't the union workers who work in the auto industry factory that build the cars. There's AutoZone, there's people who make the equipment that shines the cars, there's people who decorate the cars, there's people who supply the little pine trees for the cars, there's people who supply the ultimate weirdest cause. It's more than a union work in a fight.
Yes, they are.
So, when the auto industry, if it went down, it just wasn't going to be the collapse of the auto industry.
True. That's true.
But back to the Democratic Party in North Carolina, my that when someone says they're going to resign, there shouldn't be anybody trying to talk you out of it, unless you're the president.
Well, I've never heard of an organization that didn't have provisions for persons who would like to resign.
I still can't wrap my head around that. You mean to tell me that once you became the chair of the state Democratic Party, you're a captive person, you had a pager and cell phone because you could not be out of reach at any time and could never resign, could never walk away?
That
sounds ludicrous to me.
Well, when you don't have provisions for that, you can do that. You can't, if you have not put your program, or design your program so that you would be able to do that.
Okay, hold on just 1 minute there, Mr. Marshall. We have another call here. And Is this Mrs. Galloway?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Mrs. Galloway. How are you, Michael Lawson? You are just too funny.
At this time, we normally the Democratic chair of Cabarrus County, Grace Lean. But since she's not called in, we'll take your call.
It's the same person, Michael. You need to not. You should not string on your listeners. I got married last Sunday, which is Mother's Day, and that's the reason why I could not go to the SEC meeting. I was going to be in Las Vegas anyway for a birthday party, and we decided, Joe and I decided, we were just going to go ahead and get married. And we did.
Did you tell the baby you were eloping?
Yes, we did tell the baby, and we had his blessing.
Oh, very good. Very good. Very good. That's
right. But now, I've listened to you talking about this whole resignation thing in the North Carolina Democratic Party, and I want to throw my few cents in, if you don't mind.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. You know, since the thing is that this has become a very muddied situation, very muddy. It should have been clear cut from the very beginning. Because as I've always said, as I said last week on your show, the question is, who knew it, when did they know it, and how much money was paid out? Those were the three questions. And that's all. Not that difficult. Three questions. Okay?
I mean, this sounds like the John Edwards trial.
Yeah, well, right. Since these revelations of a sexual harassment thing came about, okay, David Parker and his supporters, they've taken every single opportunity to claim that David, quote, did nothing wrong. All right? The fact of the matter is, but let me finish. The fact of the matter is David Parker did almost nothing right. So let me go through a few of these things, and I'm going to back everything that I say up with facts. Okay, and backed up by the kind of organization, the different sections that I will quote them. So let's go through point number one. Point number one, that David Parker negotiated a settlement of action, a settlement of agreement with Adrian Ortega's sexual harassment claims without the approval of the executive council. Okay, now that, keep that in mind. Very important. Around about November or December of last year, historically, now I'm going to go back to this, okay, historically. Take notes, Michael, so you can ask me questions.
Okay.
About November, December of last year, members of the Executive Council reported that before David's action became public, okay, about the sexual harassment thing, they received emails concerning rumors suggestive of these particular disclosures. Well, Governor Perdue's office learned of the same rumors in late November, early December, and had Parker informed of the circulation of these rumors. At that point in time, David Parker should have called a meeting of the Executive Council or informed the Executive Council collectively. Now, I was a member of the Executive Council at that time, and I can tell you that no such meeting, no such information was divulged. So I became suspicious that something was going on. I didn't know what was going on, but I sure knew as hell something was going on. Well, at that point in time, David Parker began negotiations and concluded a settlement, paying Ortega from party accounts without a vote from the Executive Council. Now, Section 4.05 of the Plan of Organization authorizes the Executive Council to enter into these agreements, not the chair. So David overstepped his boundaries right there and then. It is the Executive Council that is the governing body of the party, between meetings of the State Executive Committee, not the chair. All right. Second point, calmly contends he did nothing wrong. Okay. Third point, David Parker, in his interview, press conference, contends that his personal investigation confirmed that Parker did nothing wrong. Okay. But then he went further and he stated that the settlement of the Ortega's claim was against his David Parker, set a judgment. Okay? And he simply said that it was the party attorney's fault. It was the party's attorney, as he was the party's attorney, was the only individual who believed that the matter should be settled, and Parker simply acquiesced to his judgment. Really?
Well, he's a 32 now.
Really? All right, so let's go on. Number four.
Yeah.
If Parker had abided by Section 4.05 of the Plan of Organization and called a meeting of the Executive Council as he was required to do, the governing body, which is the Executive Council of the party, may have decided not to settle the claim. Or we might have found another resolution that wouldn't have left us in such an embarrassing situation. Or at the very worst, we would have had knowledge of it, we could have disseminated the information to the different party chairs and the elected officials and yada yada, so we wouldn't be hit suddenly and smack in the face by an overnight press release. Okay, something in the paper. All right? So because of Parker's actions, he essentially left the Democratic Party in having settled a claim of sexual harassment, which we knew nothing about, because, quote, our lawyer made us do it. It's like saying the devil made me do it. Right? Makes no sense. So
maybe.
It gets better. It gets better, Michael. So these are pretty astounding, right? Pretty damn astounding, because David, this is number five now, David Parker, who is an official of the party, now bound the party to a settlement that portrays the party in a horrible light. I don't care if he wants to portray himself in a horrible light, but he's portraying the party in a horrible light to the public during one of the most important political elections in our history.
Right.
Would you guys tend to agree with this?
Yep,
okay.
Absolutely.
Now, if the Executive Council had been properly advised, according to Section 4.05 of the Plan of Organization, we would have, at the very worst, been prepared, and at the very best, this would never have happened.
If they were prepared, they could have had a reasonable message to have out there in the meantime.
We might have just said to Adrian Ortega, no, you have no, you know, we might, the chances are this. We as a state as a council have a tendency to do this. Wait a minute, what are you doing? You're claiming what? And, you know, anyway, the bottom line is, number six, is that David Parker improperly authorized the payment of settlement funds from a party account without authorization. With me. He did not get the prior authorization. This is Section 4.06 of the Plan of Organization.
Right.
Parker did not receive specific budget authorization to dispense these funds. He therefore had no independent authority to expend these funds. Now, people are telling me Parker did nothing wrong. Point of fact, he did everything. Point of fact, he did nothing right. He did everything wrong. Now let's go into the next issue, which I find the most egregious. We know the Democratic Convention is coming to North Carolina for the first time in history. Okay. The world is going to be looking at us. Parker cannot be the issue. If he stays as the chair, okay, he will be the news that ensnares the president.
Absolutely.
Correct? So if he shows up, it will be all about him. If he doesn't show up, it will still be all about him.
That's right.
Now, because, look, remember when President Obama came to Chapel Hill to talk about student loans?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what? He was there to talk about student loans, and instead he started getting questions about the sexual harassment thing with Parker. Are we as Democrats going to allow our president to come into this situation? But evidently, people like June Mabry don't mind that. Yes, I mentioned her name, and she's going to call me and yell at me. I don't care. Evidently, the people who voted for Parker to keep Parker, you know, with his resignation, don't care. They don't care that they will put our president in such a bad situation. Evidently. Okay? Now, listen. David Parker is already persona non grata on the host committee of the DNC. His position has been suspended. Now,
is that right?
One last, Yeah. One last
okay.
thing. One, not one, two last things.
Yeah, what did Boss your thing?
You know Gary Pierce. Gary Pierce
yeah.
is Jim Hunt's protege. He wrote
yeah.
a memo. He wrote early in the scandal, memo to Parker. You cannot cover up sexual harassment. Democrats deserve to know what the hell happened and how much money it's costing. And don't blame your political enemies, because that's what Nixon would do. That's when he wrote. Okay? That's when he wrote.
Yep.
Now, I have been all over Facebook. I have been drug through the mud by people because they keep going on and on and on about the tax checkoff money, about fundraising, about yada, yada, yada. They're going on about the money. Michael, it is not about the money. It is not about the money. First of all, J.J., Jefferson Jackson, is the biggest
yep.
fundraiser for the Democratic Party. Last year, Ken Lewis, who chaired the committee, and he brought in the bulk of, if not all of the funds. Beyond that, you
on
know,
the
donors, the big donors is what
I'm on the radio
about.
On the other phone.
Beyond that, you know, Ellen Stankiewicz and, you know, whom Kara Hollingsworth, those guys were also doing their little fundraising competition things. You know, they were also, hell, I brought in songs of two tables worth.
Right.
So you're talking about different people who were donors, you know, so I don't recall David Parker ever calling me and asking me to donate, ever, nor to thank
right.
me.
Yeah.
Okay, Grace,
let me, Marshall, I want you to chime in on what Grace has said so far.
Well, you know, she's right on. She's absolutely right on the money when she talks about the process. The process did not take place. Anytime you have expended or spent other folks' money, you need to tell them what you're spending it for. And particularly in that sense, you needed to go back to the executive committee to get permission to spend the money. And as I talked with other folks on that executive commission, that their position was, we don't know how much it was. So there's a whole lot of iffy stuff here. And it is an embarrassment to the president, to the state of North Carolina. We're anticipating the first time in the history of this country having a convention, national convention in North Carolina. And yet the Democratic Party is faced with all of this mess that's going on internally in the party. Kind of anti-climax to the fact that we are hosting the national convention this year, and I think we need to do something to clean this mess up now.
Yeah.
I don't think
yeah.
enough voices has been said. People have spoken. I think that last Saturday was a tobacco that had already been prearranged. How they got there?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
It was staged. Let me tell you, it was staged. And I said that from the very beginning. It was an absolute staged event. Calling it on Mother's Day, when graduation occurs and prom occurs, give me a break. There
absolutely.
Were, 472 people, a maximum 500 people, a little over 500 people that were there. And most of them that were there were proxies who didn't have a clue as to what was going on.
30% were probably proxies.
And not only that, but David Parker comes out, and he's not even on the agenda. I wasn't there, but I was getting tweets, and I was getting, you know, text messages step by step of the way, all right? But David Parker, who's not even on the agenda, comes out, and he makes this rah-rah speech about, you know, how essentially how wonderful he is. And these people who are proxies who don't have a clue what's going on go, yeah, well, let's vote for this guy because he knows what he's doing.
Well, what about the...
Let me just add this to the people who had were there to offer their services as the new chair. Some of those folks, I've been involved in Democratic politics since 1972, and I've never seen them at any of our Wake County party meetings, any of the state parties, or any of the county conventions. Anything affiliated with the Democratic Party, but yet you offer yourself as new chair with your entourage people.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a slate of people who were willing to become the new chair, but they were not working Democrats.
Yeah.
So they were people who all of a sudden decided that I can be chair of the party and offer myself. And
I
think we had other folks who were more capable, who had given time and service to the party. They were a little reluctant to get involved because of what's happening right now within the Democratic Party. Because whoever takes over after Parker inherited his mess.
That's right. Absolutely correct. I just want to tell both of you that I'm sitting here with three young voters who are listening to this fiasco and are wondering, what the hell is going on? Because, hey, is it this difficult? Or do we make it this difficult?
Well, it is difficult. And what I have done, and I'm going to tell you this, I put this on Facebook because I'm so frustrated and so annoyed. People have said, well, why can't we just get along and we'll go work to get these people elected and we'll go work to get Obama elected and just accept the fact that David Parker is the chair. And my position is, no, I will not. There's a line drawn in the sand. I cannot support David Parker and President Obama. I have to choose one or the other because I will not put my president in a situation of embarrassment by continuing to endorse David Parker as the chair. I will not do that. I will not put my president in that position of embarrassment. Do you want to do that? Do you want to do that? I ask everybody. And the response that I get is, wow, you're taking it so personally. I'm taking it personally? No, it's not about me. It's about the president, it's about our state, and it's about our country. This is nothing personal. This is not about my bread and butter, okay? Nothing personal.
Well, that's the thing, that this was not supposed to be a referendum on David Parker. It should have been a referendum on the Democratic Party. We do, and this is not like, you have a coach out there. The coach don't play the game. The players play the game. Now, you need a coach to set some strategy. But at this point in time, the strategy has already been set. We just need to play the game. But now when you're taking people off the field because of what the coach did, you now have a major problem with the game.
Well, right, and I've been accused. I've been accused of asking people to do something illegal by demanding that we be told about the sexual harassment incident when it occurred. And the claim that was made was that it was a non-disclosure agreement, okay, and so it could not be disclosed. Well, listen to this. David Parker ignored that non-disclosure agreement. Now, when it suited him, he hid behind the non-disclosure agreement. But then when it suited his purposes, he ignored it and disclosed every single detail to the public. So how come he can do it and it's not legal when it suits him? But I can't demand to know what's going on as a member of the Executive Council? Yes, I was accused of asking people to do illegal things. Because I said, no, I as a member of the Executive Council need to know what's going on. All I want is for people to follow the plan of organization. Now, I got another accusation from someone saying, well, the plan of organization does not supersede legality. Again, you've got people who make the same claim, okay, where I have something legal. But they hid behind, they supported David when he hid behind that non-disclosure agreement. They said, well, it's because it's something legal. But when he came out and divulged the information, they said, well, it's because the plan of organization said he should. Wait a minute. First you're telling me legal trumps the plan of organization. Now you're saying the plan of organization trumps legal. No, you all need to make up your mind and quit spinning this. You sounded like Republicans, what I told him.
Right, he's a lawyer. That's lawyerese. And you see, that's what that is. But listen, I'd like you, I get five more minutes with you. I want you to tie up, where do you think, Grace, and then Marshall, where do you think we need to go from here?
Well, we need to find, I personally feel that we need to find some way to remove Mr. Parker. Okay, whether, I quite frankly don't know. There's got to be a way. I wish he would just be a gentleman and resign like he told Walter Dalton he was going to. Again, he lied and he made the... Now, what kind of an ethical man would lie? You promised you would resign, now you come back? You know?
It's a shade of the truth.
Girl.
Harvey? Marshall?
Yeah, I'm here. I agree. I think, you know, but there's so much damage been done at this point, nationally, statewide. If David leaves now, we would still be faced with some of the things I just talked about, with persons who were really capable of filling the slot as executive director.
Right.
But will they come forward now? And we'll be left with what we have. And the persons that came forward, in my own opinion, they were not entitled to even think about becoming the new executive person at the Democratic Party, and because they had done nothing. You know, I think each person who pays their dues, you got to pay some dues if you want to. And leadership is a very hard and difficult process.
Right.
And
all
it's
right.
not
so,
something
so.
You jump up and do overnight. It takes time that you become a leader, the kind of leader you are. You know, Mike, for the last, three executive state directors we've had of the party, they were all about like David Parker or worse. So, you know, you and I have gone through some rounds with a couple of them and found out that they were not about doing the work of they segregated elements within the party and they disenfranchised others.
Yep.
So I think that if the party decides and what they need to do is that executive committee needs to call a special meeting and I think the people were there last Saturday. A lot of them had other folks proxy, and they were not aware of the ongoing situation. So when you're not aware, and we need to have folks in place there at this meeting that can address the issues and the kinds of things that we need to do as a party to stay viable. This is a critical year for us.
Yep.
Critical year. The president's going to be here in September.
Right.
He's going to be nominated president, our candidate from the party, and that's going to happen in North Carolina. You don't want somebody standing up there on national TV and world TV, David Parker, who has all these scandals under his belt. So we need to clean our own act up before we go out and do bigger fools of ourselves.
Can I show my perspective?
Hold on a minute, Grace. Who's the one that said at the meeting that we don't want people who are not familiar telling us what to do or something like that?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Here were the candidates. Let me tell you who the candidates were who threw their hat in the ring for chair. Okay? One was Don Vaughn, and he has been an elected official in the past. But I wouldn't trust Don Vaughn because he has a 30-year history with ALEC, okay, which is a subsidiary of the Koch brothers. So Don Vaughn is out of the question. Then we had two others, okay? One was Marianne Baldwin, whom I happen to like very much.
But she has done nothing with the party now. Remember that.
I understand that. I completely understand that. But just because she has done nothing with the party, to me, doesn't do the squat, doesn't mean do the squat. If she can lead, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a leader, all right? Because
I think we're all looking for that leadership.
David Parker came in because he had done, quote, so much for the party. He had spent 50 years, first as a young Dem, a born Dem, and a young Dem, and a teen Dem, and a whatever Dem. So he worked his way up to the rank. So according to everybody else, that's why they voted for him, because he had done for the party. The problem is, once you're entrenched in the party, you're too entrenched in the party. We need fresh blood. Okay, so there was Mary Ann Baldwin and Frank Eaton. Now, Frank Eaton's a young guy who's got great ideas. For me, my concern is, let's bring in some fresh blood, please. Can we just bring in some fresh blood? Because I am tired and tired and tired of the same old, same old. The same argument was made for Barack Obama. He's not been around long enough. He can't do anything. He ain't been around long enough. He's probably one of the best presidents that we've had in a long time. So that argument in my little brain doesn't wash.
Okay, yeah, well,
we need fresh blood.
Yeah, we got another 2 minutes here. So what do you say, Marsh?
I was saying that President Obama has been grooming himself to become a leader, and I think that makes a difference between Marianne and some other folks who have been grooming themselves to be leaders. They have not been doing that.
Well, actually, Marianne has. You see, that's the thing. Marianne actually has, but she and pardon me, you know, but I also think that her being a tough woman. And grooming
her,
she's tough.
Let me ask you a question. Was there a vote, or was this bigger popular matter?
It didn't even come up for a vote. It didn't keep this. That's why it was a whole shenanigans. The whole thing was a circus. It was orchestrated and laid out to keep David Parker.
All right, let me tell you what was supposed to play out. Congressman David Price was supposed to carry out the election process. But when the folks came back and tried to manipulate the situation with the process, and that didn't happen. And someone made a motion from the floor. And the motion was carried out, and that was in the process and bring David Parker back. And the people voted to bring David Parker back, and it was not a ballot vote, it was a voice vote, by the way, y'all. It was a voice vote.
Well, I guess, see, I would have been any good anyway. I had laryngitis.
I didn't. My vote would be that as it was the first time, the second time, and the last time. No.
Well, I got to tell you, there was another theory that was put out also. There was another proposition that was put out. And there's so many propositions, but this proposition to me was very interesting. And that was remove David Parker, have Gwen step down, and have Zach run to fill in the interim position, because Zach was the only one that got like an overwhelming majority of the vote of the NCC. You know, and hey, at this point in time, I'm up for anything. I'm open for anything.
Well, you know, during the whole process, Gwen kind of lost the group a couple of times, and they had to go back and regroup, so... I don't think she would have been a good leader if gotten to her elected her as the new chair.
Well, listen, we're going to continue this, and I want to have my the young voters here that I'm sitting with have a few things to say about this before we move on to other things. But I want to thank Ms. Galloway for being on the show today, and you asked me to look up something for you, and that is going to be at the Vietnam War Memorial. It's going to be at Thompson Park tomorrow
at 3 p.m.
At 3 p.m. Can you tell us something short about that, Grace? Grace? Hello, Grace? Did I lose you?
I think she's gone.
She couldn't have been gone. She's supposed to announce this. Well, Rooster Dad, I guess I will announce it. Yes, she is gone. Tomorrow, matter of fact, why don't you read it to Matt?
All right. At 3 p.m., the local Marine Corps League will present an Armed Forces Day memorial. There'll be a Marine Color Guard, a keynote speaker, author Joe Galloway, who wrote We Were Soldiers Once and Young, the true account of the Vietnam War's first major battle that was made into a popular movie. There'll be a 21-gun salute and wreaths placed at the Granite Wall by relatives of many of the 105 Mecklenburg natives who died in the long and divisive war and whose names are inscribed on the wall. And this will be at the Granite Wall in Uptown Thompson Park tomorrow at 3 p.m.
Okay, that's what Grace wanted to know, and I want everybody else to know that's where it's going to be. That's what you said, 3 p.m.?
Mm-hmm. It's between 3rd and 4th Street.
Between 3rd and 4th Street. Everybody, so you heard that. So be there tomorrow. And Joe Galloway, by the way, is the husband of this Grace Lean Galloway who we just heard. So, Marshall, you can stick around, or are you going to be going?
I'm going to stick around for a little bit, Mike.
Good, good, good. Right now, I have, where's the other one? He's gone. Like, I have two young people here who are voters, and I want to just ask them what they think of the shenanigans that they heard for the last 45 minutes. Matthew, tell us.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I'm pretty far removed from men like David Parker and their influence, even though they had it directly over me. At the end of the day, though, it seems like somebody like Gwen Wilkins has a lot more, has a lot better prospects, not only for the Democratic Party here in North Carolina, but for the re-election of President Obama. I feel like, as her deputy, it should have been a very easy decision. But this delayed resignation, I feel, is just once again another sign of a bloated and slow process in government. And I think it's going to ultimately end up hurting the reputation of the Democratic Party, especially in North Carolina, and this is not at a good time at the advent of Amendment 1. I think these kind of things are compounding, and it's starting to become more and more ironic and less exciting that the DNC convention is going to be in charge.
What do you think about the process where you can't resign?
I think your guest raised a good point. In those kind of systems, unless you have a precedent or a formal way that outlines how that would go down, in a sense, there really is difficulty in determining how that process would take place. It can make it very, very, very ambiguous. And I think that leaves room for people to stay there longer than they wish or should. I think it's both.
We do have a process, and it's called counsel review. So if you have done anything tawdry or moralistic, you could be one person in the SEC, which is the State Executive Committee, can put in a complaint, and that process has to be heard by the council review. So this is a process, and I don't understand why nobody presented this process. Marshall, can you tell us why that didn't happen?
No, I didn't get all of that, Mike, but would you mind repeating that?
Why didn't anybody on the SEC present this to the council of review, which is the legal way of getting someone out of an elected position in the state?
Well, it was never presented for that type, that council of review. No one. It was so orchestrated by David Parker that I don't think that it would have come up anyway. The council, its proper channel would have been to go through the council of review, but that did not happen. David Parker made all the decisions on the action that was taken.
Well, you see, the thing is, the council review, someone in the SEC can refer, goes to their county leader.
County executives are on the council review.
That's right. So and then they go to them. They don't have to go to David Parker. They can send them a note saying, hey, this is what we're doing. I think that'd be wise. But
That didn't happen, Mike, because David Parker was leading leading everything. He was making the decision. He made the decision on the payment. He made the decision on the revealing of what had actually happened. So he made a decision on hiring the guy. Why do you have to go to South Carolina to hire somebody to be responsible for our Democrats in North Carolina? Do we not have capable people in North Carolina that could have filled that position that we knew something about?
No, that's the issue. South Carolina, where they have 14 people registered as Democrats.
I've got a question, yes. Mark. I don't know why. I thought maybe you'd have some insight on this. But I was wondering why back in April, when you had Governor Perdue and other Democrats who came out, and say, you know, this whole scandal, the first scandal when it hit, this is, this is grounds for removal of Parker. And then, you know, on my birthday, the 19th, they turned around, and that sort of dissipated. Now, I know Mike's worried about this going to the council, and that sounds like it should have been precedent that was upheld. However, I feel that a governor, the leading executive for any state, the call for resignation should be enough. And in this case, why was that called and then reversed? what sort of political motivations, if there were any, were there that made that happen?
It wasn't reversed, but it's ignored by David Parker, because the governor does not have direct control of the party apparatus. Yes and no. I mean, this is what they're saying. Marshall?
I'm here.
All right, what do you think?
I tell you, when the governor literally asked for his resignation, in essence, he should have resigned at that point.
Yes.
But that didn't happen. I think she should have insisted on him.
Well, realistically, does the governor have the power to get rid of or force out the state chair?
She has that power.
Oh, but doesn't she have the plan of organization, though?
Well, her being the chief executive officer of the state, I think that it's inherited in her position.
I don't think so. And that's the reason why he didn't do it. He ignored her, because it doesn't say in the plan of organization, and even the governor has to back the plan of organization.
Well,
now.
I don't know, Mike. I was trying to find my copy of the plan of organization here today, but I got so much junk in this office.
The governor is in the ATOL in the plan of organization. So the only people that can do that is that council review. So, but Matt brings up a very good question. What's the story here? How come it doesn't say that? But you see, suppose you had a Republican governor. Could that Republican governor tell the Democratic chair of the Democratic Party to resign? I don't think so. So that's why it's not in the plan of organization.
Yeah. I tell you.
So
what.
It does not have direct authority. Although you would think as the highest, well, it's just like the President of the United States. Does the President of the United States have the ability to tell the governor of New Jersey to resign? I don't think so.
They don't, but I think there's a not expressed power in those executive positions. If I was the head of the Democratic, party in North Carolina district, and it's just one district, and the governor of the highest executive state that represents the same party as I do called for my resignation, I would seriously take into account that opinion. I don't know how you can detach yourself from an opinion like that, and just completely ignore it and keep working with that individual. That's after the allegations.
When it's all about you, you can ignore anything.
I'm sure it was just forced play. I'm sure they were just forced play.
They were just forced play. That's right. That's right. Marshall, I have the Musa brothers here. And is it Matthew? You're going to receive something from me?
Huh?
Or is it both of you?
My brother's better half,
for better half. Right?
Yep.
Smart one.
Yes. Me and her actually are two awardees of the German Language and Cultural Foundation scholarship that encourages expanding one's education while in Germany through the Goethe Institute. It's a good opportunity for students who want to learn more about German language and culture. It's kind of like an immersion course. But today is going to be a Winroth Award ceremony. The GLCF is recipient of that award. It's a very prestigious award in the Charlotte area, and they've been decided because of their outstanding basically their outstanding outreach and effect on students, and not just on the collegiate level, but also in just the secondary education level, that they're going to get that award, and Anthony Fox will be there himself to award it to the head of the GLCF.
So in the GLCF is what, the German
Language and Cultural Foundation.
So, Marshall, did you hear that?
Yeah.
And so they're going to be visiting with our mayor here in Charlotte, Anthony Fox. And they're going to receive this award this evening. And they're both graduates of UNC.
UNCC.
Oh, UNCC. I'm sorry, I left off that last C.
That's an important C.
Yes, it is.
It's
an important last C. So as education goes, these things might be fait accompli if we lose the entire Assembly and Senate, because they won't be proposing any of these because they won't have the money. So this is some of the things that is going to happen if, in fact, we lose the state completely. So I know you're very much involved in education up there at Raleigh. How do you see that playing out, Marshall, the education system?
Mike, right now it's such a big issue with education, the lack of funding, particularly in our system here in Wake County, where we're now dealing with the tobacco that the Republican majority left us with here in this system. We had a system that was not perfect, but it was one that was working to a degree. And it had been looked at all over the nation, and people have said that's a good idea, a great beginning. Now we're trying a new scheduling. Some kids have chosen schools that they have no transportation to because of budget cuts. We're having to change hours on certain schools, so that's going to affect the parents who are working. They have to adjust their hours so that they can be home with these young kids at the time that they need. We have some young kids that are getting out before the sun comes up. So, Michael, our education system in North Carolina now is really one that's in flux, is a better word for it. But it's messed up, and it all goes back to that building on Jones Street. Legislature children, where those folks have decided to do everything in their power. You know, it's almost as if you got a kid who has a new toy, and he's going to do everything he can to destroy his brothers and sisters' toys because he wants to be the king of the hill. And I duly hope and believe that the people of North Carolina are going to rise up and vote these guys out before they completely, and I hate to use this analogy, Mississippi, we become Mississippi in education.
Okay, we're right on top of it right now. As a matter of fact, the cost of education, I mean, in the times that you guys were going to school, how much did it increase?
Tuition?
Yeah.
It raised about, I want to say, anywhere between like $200 and $250 a semester, almost, at least $250 a year, which is not a lot, but you have to remember we also go in the state system.
Right.
So they're going to be a little bit more careful. And also the tuition at our school is affected by the massive growth that Charlotte has had and how much Charlotte
outstanding every year. So they are also trying to bring in football. So a lot of that accounted into the tuition. But tuition overall over the state has gone up in the past.
Well,
it's inherited in our It's inherited within our Constitution that North Carolina citizens have a right to an affordable and reasonable education. With the increase in tuition for our colleges and university, part of the university system, we're pricing our own people out of the educational system. And if we look at our high schools are lacking in certain equipment, computers and science equipment that's needed in our science labs. So we're going against our own constitution in doing these things.
You say something, Gavin? I was just going to say, also with the CMS here, the high school, middle school, you see more and more trailers and less extension of buildings and just, you know, pumping a couple dollars in the older schools in Charlotte. And I don't know, there's this huge influx of more and more people and less money, and I don't understand where they think this is actually going to go, you know, Peter Gorman got out, and then, you know, it's like, there's a reason why people are still not happy with what's happening, but yet they're not really doing anything either at the same time. I think at the end of the day, young voters, when we think of the education system in North Carolina, we ask the question, what's going to be done in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years that's going to keep not only North Carolina's education system from going farther down, but becoming better and making the state more competitive as a place to live for those of us who want to get education here and then get, hopefully, work here. Emphasis on the hopefully.
Hold on, we got a call. Hold on. Let's see who this is. Hello there, who's this?
Hey, this is Mr. Musa.
Mr.
Musa, listen, first of all, I want to tell you I thoroughly enjoy your show. A very interesting subject content. More importantly, I'm impressed with your guests that you have, especially my two boys. But I have to tell you, Mike, what I was most amazed about with the boys getting these supplement help from that German organization, and they both speak German fairly fluently, is to find out that there are over 250 German-type businesses in the Charlotte area. This increases their, dramatically increases their chance for employment. And it just seems odd to me that we're getting all this help from the outside of our own nation, basically to help our people here and help themselves certainly get qualified employees.
Uh-huh. And you mean to tell me that these guys didn't come out of the room speaking
Hello,
German?
I'm on the phone.
Yeah,
sorry?
You mean they didn't come out of the room speaking German?
No, we don't speak German in our house prior to their education.
I think Bob raises a good point here, and that is that organizations like the German, the GLCF, the German Language and Culture Foundation, are actually a really interesting way to get education improved in North Carolina and to encourage a growth towards education leading to jobs. I think that with the private sector getting involved in education, not on the level to influence decisions made, for specific schools, but when private interests get involved and puts out things like scholarships, internships, awards, and special paths for students to follow, I think they encourage people to take advantage of that. On the high school level, the collegiate level, I think when private interest gets involved in things like that and makes an investment in the public education system.
That's so true, but why is it that it's done from foreigners to our country? Have a greater input to it than businesses and corporations within our own country. I just find that it's they seem to have missed the ticket in that area.
That's a good question to raise. That's a very good question to raise. At the same time, I would wonder, I would say that any help at this point, especially in North Carolina's education system, is help that's appreciated.
That's true.
Well, you know, if German-speaking businesses have such a keen interest in our young American citizens coming out of college, you would think that either the corporate America has either completely gone down a different path or have totally missed the mark, where they can get specialized personnel, you know, to do what they need. And they seem to throw all the students, all the college students, into one large bin and pick from it, be it the good, bad, or the ugly, versus the German-speaking industries and corporations seem to hand-pick and cherry-pick, as we would say, the best of the best. I just think, you know, more people should look at that so they can appreciate not only the due diligence that you and your brother have put forth, but also the cost of the education which you have fronted, you know, to achieve that level.
Organizations like the GLCF and other people like them, other places overseas that offer incentives for students over here, they're really just an example of specialization of labor and now the specialization of education. They're investing in America's youth as possible to help support their end, but if American corporations, American big business, they invest in their own ways, usually on a much grander scale, not just specifically as a single or specific scholarship. At the end of the day, I think it's a larger commentary on the development and growth of big business in America and how business in America has become very international. You have a lot of multinational-based corporations now whose interest is spread out among the entire world. And as German companies are coming over here in the Charlotte area, investing in not only the infrastructure and the resources we have as a city, you know, number two in banking in all of Northern America, and our youth as well, but I think at the same time there are other companies, you know, companies in America are reaching other places for
work. Yeah, let me ask you a question, Matt. Let me ask you a question. But you see, Charlotte, though, isn't our patron saint here, wasn't she from Germany?
Queen Charlotte.
So is that the reason why the German industries look more favorable?
I doubt it, because they probably just would have gone to Minnesota if they wanted to get their home. At the end of the day...
Mike, they probably are moving here in vast quantities because they have an opportunity to buy up large bank buildings very inexpensively now.
Well, did the Chinese sell out of them?
They already owned them prior to... So, well, listen, I'm going to let you guys go. I just want to say thanks for having the boys on and appreciate everything you're doing.
All right. That was good.
All right. See you later, guys.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We got Marsha. You still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. So what do you think about that, about the investment that the Germans are investing here in the Shaw area? I don't know how much of investment is. Do you see that investment in Wake County?
Yeah, there are a lot of foreign investors in Wake County. Our biggest problem would be a lot of folks are out in the Research Triangle Park.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of major corporations that have decided to move in, and you know that we're getting ready to use up the remainder of the land that is in the park, so it will become a much larger park and able to accommodate others. I see in the uptown area of Raleigh, there are businesses that are outside of this country. We have a lot of businesses that are coming in downtown. You know, we have a consulate here, and we are the only city outside of Atlanta, Washington, D.C., and New York that has a consulate. It's the Mexican consulate.
Oh, yeah.
We have a real large population in this area of Hispanics, and the Hispanics that are here are hardworking and very, very, very dedicated folks. they can get a lot of their answers at the consulate here done. So that's an interest that it's been done. Why was Raleigh made home of the only consulate outside of those other three cities I mentioned earlier?
Right.
We have a rapid growth of the Hispanic population. I think our Asian population has grown. Our population has grown. I have two neighbors that are from England now. Did not have before, and our population of folks from the Arabic countries growing tremendously, and that's primarily the university system here in really responsible for a lot of that growth. A lot of science and people who are doing research, particularly in the Bassanio campus that we have. North Carolina State University has, and there's a lot of research companies out there headed.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about that is that, see, I've known these two boys since they were mere pikes. Well, they never were mere pikes, but when they were mere pikes. And I wanted to talk to Jonathan, who's the oldest one. We haven't heard so much from Jonathan. Tell us how you got, what's your degree in?
I just finished my master's in history, but I have bachelor's in German and history as well.
And you weren't always going to go down this path?
No, I started in computer science, internship at Microsoft in high school, and got accepted to NC State to get into their electrical engineering program, but it didn't really click for me.
Well, you see, I know you were a computer whiz.
Maybe at one point.
At one point.
Now it's
a couple of days. That's part of it. Okay, but what sort of, because there's a lot of kids out there who are going to school, who are not going to school, who are thinking about going to school, who might not think about going to school. And what actually took you or got you to the point you said, you know what, I need to do this?
Well, to get a degree, you mean?
No, you need to go to school because I got to do this in order to get from A to B.
Well, I guess starting off, it was, my parents said you need to go to college. Neither of my parents went. They did well for themselves, but they still thought it was important for us to get an education. But like a lot of people, I was undecided for a while. I switched majors a bunch of times. And I think you really have to sit down and find what you're good at, what you have talent for, and then whether or not you can use that to your advantage.
Well, I see. See, I remember, and you might not remember, I saw you one time at the Sam's Club. Okay. And you were at Sam's Club, and I said, well, Justin, what do you go to? He said, I don't know, but I'm in between. You weren't that sure. That was like close to Christmas or something.
Right.
Yeah. And so, but the kicker, what was the actual kicker? I said, it's like the, that commercial with the weightlifter on TV, and he says, I said, this is just hard for me. I can't do it. And then I said, I need to do it. Mm-hmm. And I forced myself, and now he's an Olympic champion. So what was that kicker that told you, hey, I need to do this because I got to get this? That there had to be something that clicked.
Well, I think it really came down to a teacher. Her name is Dr. Annabelle Brucknow, and I had trouble, and I had lost interest. Like you said, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I had lost interest. I wasn't doing as well as I should have. And she really got behind me and said, if...
With a shoe?
Yeah, with a shoe. But she's part of the gym department at UNCC, and she said, if I can see you doing anything, but if you want to do something with this, then I'll help you do that, whatever I have to do. So she always helped me with my work and stayed after and was there for as an advisor, even though she's my actual advisor. And it's just when you see somebody who wants to give themselves you and they don't necessarily want anything back. It's like what all teachers strive to be, that teacher that, you know, you look up to, and like, what can I do for you? And they're like, well, I didn't even think about that, because they did not. It just, like, it worked out. I guess that's one of the things. And it's just, I've always had interest in my inches and history, and that I went, and I was just now finishing my graduate work in history, in German history, and I love the history from over there. We're not German at all, but I still found it interesting. And so now I'm up just doing teaching over there for a year at a boarding school.
Are they all, with one of your things about teaching over there, are they all actual Germans, or are they from all over the world?
They're from all over the world, but they're there at that boarding school to learn German culture. I guess just for me, as an American, I mean, I've lived a couple places on the East Coast, and we come from a cultural background, and, you know, I've loved a thing that was more diverse than it was homogeneous.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was more interesting that way, and if you spoke another language, or if you just came to the country, I just found it was more interesting, because you had, you know, you're still, everything was still new to you.
Right.
And to me, that's why I love being overseas. You know, you go outside the door, everything is new. To me, at least.
Right.
Or
right.
Someone's been living there with their family.
Right.
Just to kind of
right.
I think sometimes in America, and I love the country, but sometimes we get sort of a narrow-minded view of the world, and I think more and more people need to go overseas. I think something like a Kukurambo, I remember reading an article that said less than 20% of Americans have passports. It's not a lot of people, but it's quite a lot of Americans. And I think that, you know, it's for one, you know, we think that, you know, if no one speaks English, then why should we go there? So, I mean, you know, this world is getting smaller. I mean, like, you're seeing businesses are coming over here from all over the world, Central America, South America. Yeah, everyone's going to speak English, and I think it's just worked better on your behalf. At least try.
Well, you know, that reminds me of one of my first cruises about 2 years ago. And we went Southern Caribbean, and I told my wife I wanted to take a no sea days where we got off the port every day, Southern Port. And so we were going to eat lunch at every port. So we went to, and I don't remember where it was at, which place we were at, but we went to this restaurant, we recommended it, it was nice in there. I had a beer when I got in there. And my wife ordered red snapper, and I ordered, I don't know, what or something. And it was their culture was the side dishes, the rice they had, and some other stuff. So there was this other couple who was newer from the ship, and they had three kids with them. And it was not expensive. It was, I mean, expensive. Maybe it was the lobster I had. Maybe it was $12, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the was, I don't know what it was, $8, something like that. Anyway, so they were sitting there, and they came in right behind us. I already had two drinks, and I'm getting through my menu. We're still looking at the menu. So I'm finishing my meal. I'm ordering another drink.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still looking at the menu. So the guy, the waiter came over to us, and he spoke very good English. And he said, are you going to order anything?
Dale,
and
before you go home and call, please.
We have for each of us.
Yeah.
No, but I tripped. I know that about $900 a piece. Okay, $800 a piece, $900 a piece. And they go to another country, and they're ordering McDonald's. I mean, what are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And it couldn't have been the price. Because they had to spend a little bit of $4,000. So, you know, and then to use the mister, and he says, Barack Obama doesn't believe in American exceptionalism. Well, what the heck does that mean? You know, nobody else in the world is better than us. That's what they're trying to say. Well, you know, that's ludicrous thinking. First of all, you don't have to think that someone's better than you.
Right.
But they can be as good as you. I mean, why, you know, they can be. Not saying they are.
Right.
But when you completely put it out of your mind, it's ludicrous. And I think that's what you're actually trying to say about getting involved and everything looks new to you when you get outside.
Well, yeah, the main thing that's always come across to me is I look up for a while is, you know, no matter where you go in this world, you know, there's people that are trying to make enough money to live, to have a whole, you know, roof over their head, provide for their family, and, you know, to have their kids have education or just at least a better life than they did. And that's everybody.
Right.
And I think when you forget those things, then you start polarizing and, like, well, they're different.
Right.
And that's bad.
Yeah.
That's what I think is great, that if you go to university or even if you look for a business or something, you can get overseas somehow. Nobody says stay there, but come back to America and tell people. I mean, it's better for America, better for your own country when you say, I've been there, I can relate,
right?
You know, and I can now use those experiences and whatever I learned and using them in my business or school or whatever.
So
I think is when you have, when you create spaces between you and others or foreigners, I think then that becomes dangerous. Because when you start assuming things, start inventing things.
Right.
Where if you just actually, you know, said hello,
right,
you'd be surprised. Turn, you know?
Marshall?
I'm still here.
Do you have anything to ask Jonathan about what he was talking about?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, we have his sidekick brother here, who's younger than him, and has a almost a different story. Matthew, introduce yourself. Well, he's been talking all along.
Well, I mean,
now I'm going to ask you the same question I asked your brother. What the heck happened? How come you're not a football player?
Well, I shattered my leg. That's the short answer. A long answer is I'm not really that good at football. I mean, other than being big, that's about it. You know, at the end of the day, for me, college was never an exciting prospect. I was going to go straight into the military, and it was my hope to do that. Unfortunately, I damaged my leg very badly, and I wasn't able to do that. So I was kind of faced with the advent at the last minute, thinking I have to go into college now. Because I at home. So my girlfriend at the time recommended that I apply for a university, and my brother already went there. It seemed like it was a decision, and I applied for UNC Charlotte, and I got in. And around the first 2 years there, I was not really a student at all. I could care less about my grades. I know I had an impressive 2.2, 2.3 GPA.
Oh, hey, you know, rocket science.
I was lucky to show up to a class if I liked it, but at the end of the day, what really happened was around my junior year, I just left that mindset behind, that college was an alternative to what I wanted to do, and instead thought to myself, well, since I planned for my education, college should be my primary focus, and it should also be the path that's going to take me to the next place instead of the path that took me from high school. And so I turned around and boosted my GPA and got involved in organizations within my degree and took on a second degree and then took on a minor. And ever since then, I've just been very lucky to have a lot of supportive professors at the university. And I've been very lucky to have a family that supports me.
Yeah, but what you say now, you boosted your GPA. What, through computer means? I mean, how did you do that?
Did you, no, it's actually quite legitimate.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, I just want to make sure. But someone would ask that. Now, how did he do this?
Yeah, I went from it's not that hard. I think about 4 semesters, I went from a 2.4 to a 3.0 just by getting 4.0s and making
changes. Just by coming to class.
Just by coming to class.
So what led you down the same path almost as your brother as far as what you were taking?
At the end of the day, I liked history because after a little bit of research and talking to some family and friends, I decided that history prepares you for many things by learning about many things, the origin and their evolution. It also helps you do things like original research, interpretation of things that you read. It helps you gain perspective, not just the side that you can read from, the side that you have to go search for that may not be in front of you. And I like that about that. I like that about life. I like giving things different perspectives. The German degree, I had to have, you have to have a foreign language requirement. And I took German in high school.
failed my one semester, and it bothered
me. What high school did you go to?
I went to Butler.
Oh, you went to Butler. And what junior high did you go to?
I went to Northridge Middle School.
And did Johnson go to?
John did go to Northridge Middle School.
Yeah.
So when,
oh, then when you then Garinger.
Then went to Garinger. But no, I failed German there, and it really bothered me. So I took German again. I did very well, and I just kept taking it. And then the same professor that inspired my brother, Dr. Annabelle Buchanan, she ended up really taking me and my brother under her wing and helping us a lot in putting our future in a possible second degree. And we both signed on for that at this time. And I feel that any degree, you know, like German, Spanish, or Russian, it doesn't matter what you're thinking, Chinese, those degrees are supplementative to your main degree, and they really help gain perspective on things. You know, I studied World War II and a lot of things in a history degree, and when you took a German degree, you have to take cultural classes too, and you start to see different perspectives of the war instead of just what the Allies came back and told what happened. You know, you start to get a fuller, more accurate picture of what has happened in the past and of what you can remember.
But we're going to get to your other extension to music, because, as a matter of fact, I might as well get to it right now. How did you get from Chardonnay to music to German?
Well, I mean, long story short,
make it short.
I broke my leg pretty bad, and in gym class, there's a lot of stuff I couldn't do. And a friend of mine who played drums was in that class in high school, and he had a practice pad and sticks, and he said, you know, pick away all the time. And he got me interested in it, and I started doing it because it's something you could do with your hands while your leg was healing. And then over time, that developed. It was the one thing I really never gave up on. I kept playing and playing and playing. Eventually, I was in the drum line my senior year, and then I just never stopped playing ever since ever since the past, I'd say, 8-9 years, I've not stopped playing. And I love it. I love the drums. I love rhythm. But, you know, more importantly, as I went through college, all these different kind of interactions with people, and culturally, you try to gain this bigger perspective. You start to change your taste. You know, nowadays, I'm really into jazz. And that's
well, we're going to talk about that in just a minute, but I want to get a hold of this other young lady that's here, and I have her say a few words. And your name is
Vera.
Name, please. Vera. Vera what?
Palamoa.
Palamoa. And where are you, Vera?
Originally, I was born in Wiesbaden, Germany.
Uh-huh.
My father.
You speak German?
I do.
Oh.
One of my names is that I graduated.
Jonathan?
No.
Oh, okay. You teach Matthew?
No.
Okay. And?
So my dad retired from the military after 22 years in American Samoa.
Is he Air Force, Army?
He was Army.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. And I'll go down there. I now live in Charlotte. I just graduated with a bachelor's in history and German. And higher.
So all three of you are German.
Are you seeing the connection?
See, there must be something.
I will say this, though. I'm the only one who has an American minor.
Oh, okay.
So I'm vastly more qualified for any position.
Oh, okay. Now, how did you meet Mr. Musa Senior here, or Junior Senior?
Well, I actually am a friend with Matt through history and German, and he introduced me to his older brother.
He did, huh?
Yes.
Oh. Pumped you off, huh? I said, look, please, take her. I have other things to do. So
that is actually exactly how it works. If you know Matt, you know exactly what I mean.
Yes. And you all, now, are you going to go to Germany?
I am not. I'm actually, I will be sitting the office candidate board on July.
Okay. Good.
I'm pretty excited.
And where is the this where is it?
It's in Charlotte. I'm assuming it's going to be in the Met Center, METS. That's my first board. It's here in Charlotte.
Okay.
And then they send my paperwork to Fort Knox, Kentucky. They review it. It's another board. I'm not there for it.
Right.
They review what was said in the first board, my paperwork, background check.
Okay. And what do you want to be? Must be intelligence officer.
It would be military intelligence, but I'm really actually interested in civil affairs, but you actually have to be in the military first before you can use civil affairs. So it's also a little bit different with officer school. You have to rank into what you're going to be. So
you can't take
tests? Well, no. Like, I had to take the ASVAB and
right.
score at a certain level.
Right.
Just to be considered for officers.
Right.
But in officers' candidate school itself, which is held in Fort Benning, Georgia,
yeah.
I would have to rank in to the position that I would want to be
okay.
in.
Okay, what rank do you have to?
Well, it would be like first place, second place, third place.
How many places do you have?
Well, however many candidates
they had
there at the time.
Okay.
So it would be based on, you know, your physical ability,
right.
your mental, everything they test you on in that school. It would be 12 weeks, I believe it is. So, but
okay.
most intelligence, sure, why not?
Why not? Hey, you're with the Musa brothers.
You know, I say the same thing.
the other thing is now, if you're going to make this career,
it would be a career for me.
It would. Okay. All right. Very good. Now, what is your parents' name?
They're all for it.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, they're all for it.
Your father's also?
My father was in this actually. He retired as E-8 Master Sergeant.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Not
so he might as well be an officer. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But he had to work really hard
right.
for that. So. But they're very optimistic, and they've supported me all the way. Goes and my choice to join the Army. They did say that they did not want me to join the Army. They were very clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
should have went to the Air Force.
Oh,
yeah. Air Force.
Apparently, I was too old for the Air Force. Everybody has to cut off somewhere.
What's the difference here? Anyway, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Holding their hands there because I know they were so nervous, these two over here. But I want to get Mr. Matthew here and tell us, Matthew, how you translated from Shattered Legs to music to jazz.
Well, basically, I've always had an appreciation for older music. And over the years, that kind of developed into, you know, when you think of older music and you think of, like big band and that kind of thing, it's kind of fun to listen to. But I felt as time went on and my taste got more complex and I started, you know, trying to think about music instead of just listening to music, I felt jazz really spoke to me more than anything. I feel, you know, it's not even just jazz in itself. I mean, there's specifics. I mean, guys like Charlie Bird Parker, you know, Miles. You got guys like Coltrane, Herbie Hancock. These are people, you know, Chick Corea. These are people that, when they play, I feel like they express so much more in the music that they produce than most of the stuff in the top 40 today. There's nothing wrong with some top 40 every now and then. You gotta shake a little bit.
But. Yeah, when I'm in shower. I mean, you know, that's the time.
Sure,
but when. I remember one time I was in the pool when you were living next door to me, and no, you weren't home. I think your brother was home, but I was out in the pool with your father. He had a cigar, he was smoking, and we were in the pool with a drink, and he says, it doesn't get any better than this. We were listening to some nice music.
Nice music is a really subjective word. Think of nice music, Nat King Cole.
It wasn't Nat King Cole. It might have been some jazz. I think it was.
My father's jazz range. No offense to my father, especially if he still listens. But my father's jazz experience
is
centered mainly around one Kenny G.
Oh.
And to the rest of the jazz community, that's like saying, I love jazz,
but
about that jazz part.
But the jazz
shut that down. That weird. And that's it.
What have you? Do you have anything that in about 2 minutes you can put together? We can listen to a little bit of stuff.
I mean,
no.
I can play like.
Well, you know what? There's. You know what we're gonna do? When we go off, you can do that.
Okay.
I'll give you a sign to give you 2 minutes head start. You go to. And you can just
there's a really easy, the mic. There's a really easy thing to do that I like to do. I did a class once, a project, and I got an A on it.
Oh.
It's the evolution of jazz, where it comes from. And it gives credit to both the European roots of America and the Afro-Cuban roots.
Oh!
And what
that called?
I mean, it's basically the Afro-Cuban clave,
right.
The island culture, and the 4/4 downbeat marching rhythm. European culture. When those two intersected in New Orleans Square, you know, that's what made jazz. That's what jazz stems from. Jazz is uniquely American experience, just as unique as those in American sense.
Well, what do you think about my Basie and stuff?
Count Basie, I mean, he's a cool cat. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, he's always
that's big band. Right.
It is big band.
That's big
but, you know, he could still write some bops.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, he worked, he worked for all the major stars, so, so I think he did do something with Michael Jackson, too.
Yeah, Gary was a hell of a band leader. Really
sure. Oh, absolutely. Right now, I am going to do my commentary before we go off. So, if you go over there and arrange. And I'll give you the high spot when I want you to go ahead. We can do that.
All right, sounds good, buddy.
Right now, I want to thank everybody for listening. And I have a commentary that I have been working on every once in a while at the end of the show. And it has to do with greed. And what needs to be done for us to better this country and to better ourselves. Ivan Boesky was a Wall Street to the SEC to settle insider trading charges. Once in a speech, Boesky said, "Greed is all right. By the way, I want you to know that greed is healthy. You can be greedy and still feel good about yourself." That's what Boesky said. In a power example, a fictitious character from the Academy Award-winning film Wall Street, Gordon Gekko said, "Greed, for the lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. The richest 1% of this country owns half of our country's wealth, over $5 trillion. Gekko further said, "I create nothing I own. We pick that rabbit out of the hat while everybody sits out there and wonders how the hell we did it." And then he said, "You're not naive enough to think that we're living in a democracy, are you? Well, we the people of the United States are the first 7 words of the country's constitution and speaks to everyone in America. By these words, citizens of the United States have chosen for themselves the rigors of a representative
republic in which the people of voting age select the person or person to represent them in our government institution. In a representative republic, which is the highest form of governmental devised government devised by man and therefore requires the greatest amount of human care and maintenance, it is our duty by voting to make sure that the person or persons representing us in government represent us in the best interest of the country. As John Adams once said, understanding the foundation of the American Republic is a vital key towards the protection of our Constitution. Adams further said, by not getting involved in our government, a democracy will soon degenerate into anarchy. Such an anarchy that every man will do what is right in his own eyes, and no man's life or property or reputation or liberty will be secure. And even every one of these will soon mold itself into a system of subordination of all the moral values and intellectual abilities, all the powers of wealth, beauty, wit, and science to the wanton and capricious will and the abominable cruelty of one of a very few. In other words, Adams was saying that if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Encourage everyone to vote, old and young. Your vote does count. It is their duty. When they fail in their duty, elections turn out badly. Sadly, some can recite just why they feel their vote does not count and feel they should give up. But they are wrong. We should never give up any rights. The less we fight for the right to control our own government, the more government control by the people in power will have. They say that 61% of the people voted for Amendment 1 last week, and therefore the people of North Carolina resoundingly are in favor of the right to marriage law of one man and one woman. However, this is not exactly true, when that vote represented only 12 to 15% of the voting population. Thomas Paine once said, "Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it." Voting is your duty as a citizen. Change this country and make it the way you want it to be by making our lives better. We owe it to our children to learn the tools of citizenship and debate. We owe it to the future of ourselves to make this a better world. Just taking what we are given is not enough. We can't be lazy about life. Our country is great, but we can make it better. A democracy is a tool that allows everyone to participate. However, we must participate, or it really isn't our country, is it? We only get out of it what we put into it. Do you wish for your children to inherit the world you helped to create for them, or let them suffer in someone else's? As good stewards of the democracy, we owe it to our children not to let others take up the slack in our society. We owe it to our children to be good citizens in an ongoing process in which every citizen of this country has an obligation to fulfill. We owe it to our children to be involved in our government by voting and volunteering to have candidates and office holders. We owe it to our children to understand how this country's government works. And now we are going to hear from Marshall. Are you still there?
Still here.
You have any last words?
Yeah. I think, Mike, I think I'd like to see a couple of things I think we need to do. We need to for some real conclusion for this thing with David Parker. Mm-hmm. I think that the lady that you had on earlier, the chairman of the Democratic Party in Mecklenburg County, I think she needs to press that issue. I think she'll find that other folks out here would press it along with her. There needs to be something done before the convention. It's going to be an embarrassment, and we don't want it to hurt the president.
Right.
When he comes to the state, and this is not just a Charlotte event; it's a North Carolina event. It affects all of us. All of us, people in Raleigh, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, Asheville, all over, Wilmington, you name it, and it affects us. The other thing, Mike, I think that we are embarking upon an era in which we have, for the first time in our history and the history of this state, that we have a black female that may be the next lieutenant governor.
Well,
What has happened?
Hello?
I'm here. What did you just say?
I said if it hasn't been already been killed by what has happened.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I think it's I think that North Carolina is maybe shedding its 1960 overcoat.
I hope so.
And I think we're looking at equality here.
Well, I hope so. I want to thank you, Marshall, for being with us. And I will be seeing you on the trail. Maybe we can get together next weekend.
Yeah, we can. We will. I'll be there. I plan to. If Walter Rogers allow me to come. Mike, have a good weekend and be safe.
Yeah, away, Teddy. And I want to say thank you, Marshall. And as I said, I will see you. Okay, right now, Matthew is sitting next to his drums. And if I, should I do a little bit of the, well, no, it's going to come on anyway. You take us into Mr., let's see, who is it? Sound Basie?
All right, so Jazz, New Orleans.
Can you walk that closer?
No, that's fine.
That's fine? Okay, great. Right.
Jazz in New Orleans started with an Afro-Cuban beat.
Okay, Jazz in New Orleans started with an Afro-Cuban beat, as Matthew said.
And clave beat, it sounds like this.
And here he goes.
Marching beats. And European marching rhythms sound like this. But nobody else except New Orleans natives from those islands would mix those two together and make this.
Reminds me of the Labor Day Parade in New York City.
In that second line.
That's right.
It eventually became this. And became modern jazz.
What? Now, you learned...
What?
You learned this all in 5 minutes, right?
Four.
4 minutes?
Yep.
Now, this is self-taught.
Yeah. Stanton Moore did that gig, that little demonstration. Stanton Moore, he's a New Orleans drummer.
Right. I know Stanton Moore. Okay, we got 30 seconds. So, Where can someone who wants to learn how to do what you just did, who should they seek out, or what should they seek out?
They should seek out YouTube. They should seek out Google, because you can learn so much on your own with resources at home instead of paying a lot of money for lessons. If you want to learn how to hold sticks well, beat sheet music and take lessons. But if you just want to learn how to have fun, jam, and learn about different other kinds of music, then the internet could be one of your biggest teachers.
Okay. Well, I think that is it. And this has been The Last Word.